Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Public Rec.
This week on Retronauts, Pool Hall Thrills. Hello, and welcome to Retronauts. This should be episode 653, if I'm counting correctly, and I am your host, Kevin Bunch. And today, we're going back to not the primordial days of coin-operated video games, per se, but definitely the era when you had the first trilobites crawling around, or swimming around. What did trilobites do again? I don't remember.
I don't know.
Exist in fossils.
Yeah. Crawl underwater?
Crawling around underwater, for sure. Yeah. So we're discussing what is generally dubbed sort of the Bronze Age of video games, which spanned the 1970s, led into the Golden Age, which really, you know, skipped a generation there, that most people seem to really be more familiar with, the Golden Age of arcades, when you had the big hits like Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and Mr. Do.
Sure.
But the Bronze Age is really fascinating. It has a lot of really cool concepts and games that are just really forgotten or overlooked nowadays. And I'm really excited to talk about them. And I brought you two folks to chat about them, too.
Wonderful.
So who do we have to my south?
Well, I can't really... Oh, to your global...
To my south.
Global south.
Yes.
Yes.
South of D.C.
South of D.C. Oh, yeah. Wait. I don't even know where you live, Kevin. You're in D.C.?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. My geography is a little hazy. Anyway, I'm Benj Edwards. I am... I don't know what I am anymore. Right now, I'm an AI reporter for Ars Technica. I used to be a tech historian. I guess I still am in a way. And that's me.
You never truly get out of it.
Yeah.
And who do we have up in New York State?
Hi, I'm Nate Lockhart. I guess we call ourselves citizen archivists. Is that right? In the Gaming Alexandria space. But I do a little podcast called The Memory Machine, which kind of talks about pop culture throughout, you know, all sorts of eras, going all the way back to like the 1850s to like 10 years ago with like flash cartoons or something. But one of my passions that I'm really involved in, which we're going to talk about a lot in a minute, is this early era of video games, mainly the pre-CPU type that are very, that are all TTL, transistor logic based. And, yeah, I've buy up schematics and try to scan them in for people so that, you know, people can do recreations on things like FPGAs. And I've also, been enamored with this one particular book. I don't know if you want me to go into that now, but maybe we could talk about it when we get there. But I've got a project having to do with that. So I guess that's me, right? Yeah.
I was going to say, you have spent a lot of time in the past couple of years, like building your own transistor logic games.
Yeah. Yes, I have.
Trying to repair a couple arcade ones too.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive.
They're tricky beasts. They really are, especially when the schematics have errors in them.
Wow.
And I referred to it before to other people as I sort of like brute forced my way through electronics training by taking on these projects. Like you just sort of start on it and you'd be like, well, I want to do this and I'm going to figure it out come hell or high water. And I guess I did. To some extent.
That's the best way.
It really is. It really is. I mean, I was really interested in electronics for a long time, you know, and I wanted to learn more about it and I would just read books and then it just never stuck. And I think one day I just said to hell with it and I like bought like a small kit and started going to town. So yeah, there you go.
And then you got the TTL game bug. Which
yes,
is helpful for this podcast.
Yes, I did.
We're going to be leaning on you quite a bit, I have the feeling.
Oh, lordy. All right.
So what makes these games interesting to you folks? I don't think any of us were necessarily conscious enough to be playing a lot of these games in the arcades during their heyday. Certainly, I did not exist yet, so...
Yeah, I was born in 81, so all this happened before I was born. My dad was an electronics engineer, so I grew up around electronics engineers. They were his friends. They were his employees when he started a company later. And he taught me about Woz, Steve Wozniak, when I was a kid, because I got an Apple II Plus. Apple II Plus was my first computer. Depending on what you call computer, I had an Atari 400 before that. That was like a game console. But anyway, yeah. So I've always been fascinated by the electronics of the 70s. It was an era where my dad was very active doing radio stuff, and he was always fixing old toys and things. And so I feel like, you know, when I first started writing about tech and video game history, I was trying to find some corner of the universe that hadn't been really studied very well yet. So I ended up really focusing on the origins of video games in the very beginning. And so, you know, I interviewed people like Ralph Baer, Nolan Bushnell, and Alan Alcorn, and those kind of people, and tried to figure out how it started. And there's such an interesting gap here, because like through my work, people know a lot about, like, say, Ralph Baer's stuff in the 60s or the very beginning of Atari, Nolan Bushnell. And then there's sort of a gap. And then you get to like the Atari 2600 and stuff, and people focus on the home machines. And then they get to like 80, 82, like the golden age of arcades, like we're talking about, like Kevin mentioned earlier. And so there's sort of this gap in history where it's a lost age of arcade history in the early 70s with these TTL games. It's really fascinating. And they, you know, we can't play them on emulators because they're not software in that sense, but they have to be simulated or reproduced. And Nate knows all about that. So I feel like, you know, I've only done limited work in this. If you count Computer Space, my big article on Computer Space in 2011 for Technologizer, that's something that's similar, but that was the very beginning. And also, I did a slideshow for, I don't know if you remember Glixel. Glixel was the site run by Rolling Stone.
Oh man.
I wrote a slideshow of early lost Atari games, and I think they're all TTL, black and white TTL games. And in 2017, and that's like totally offline now. I need to republish it. I think it's lost.
What is Glixel? What is that even like a, a portmanteau of? Like, what is that supposed to mean?
Glue and pixels. I don't know.
Is that it? I don't
know. Was Jiminy Glick there? Is that involved somewhere?
God, I don't know. Papa was a rolling stone, Boston, yeah. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. And when he died, only the death was well known. Well, then.
What about you, Nate?
Yeah, I was nowhere near these games when they were in their heyday. I wasn't born until 87. So for me, this is just sort of like a pure fascination. You know, I've always been kind of interested in video game history and looking backwards. I think I was first fascinated by them just by looking at Van Burnham's book, Supercade, back in the day. And she had some very limited, but there were still some very tantalizing, like, flyers, you know, for these games that I couldn't play, that were like hardly any screenshots of them, like things like Space Race. That's it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and just sort of looking at it from afar, or Computer Space for that matter. I remember playing a two-player Computer Space at Philly Classic 3, which would have been like 2002, I think.
Going way back.
And yeah, a fella named Cassidy Nolan had a two-player Computer Space machine. Oh. And that was the coolest thing in the world, and I loved it. My dad and I played it a lot. It was a really fun time. But I really got, well, the thing that really sucked me in was when I was 10 years old, I lived in a little town called LaGrange, Georgia for about 4 years. And before and after that, I grew up in Rochester, New York. But they had this book there that was just absolutely fascinating to me. And it was called How to Design and Build Your Own Custom TV Games. And I was always fascinated by the idea of, you know, video game creation. It's something I always wanted to do. I messed around in like BASIC, right, for a little bit. You know, I looked at like C++ code for a minute and got super confused. But this was something else entirely. And I saw like this book has, you know, diagrams of control panels and like little like crude illustrations about what the games are supposed to look like. And these things in them that I don't know what they are. They're these weird diagrams, and I take it to my dad and I said, Dad, can we do this? You know, can we take a look at these games, see what they are? And he was like, Oh no. He's like, these are schematics and absolutely not. But it was something that just stayed in the back of my brain for decades, honestly, until really the pandemic hit. And, I had a lot of time. And I remembered that book. In fact, I had gotten my own copy by that point. And I had dabbled a little bit with electronics here and there. Like, I think I built like a little LM386 amplifier, you know, little things like that. And I built a joystick converter for a TI-99, cause they use this weird diode switching system. But, I opened that book up during the pandemic and looked at it and I was like, oh my God, I get this now. I understand this. I know what this is doing. I could do this. Surely. And that's what sent me off this dark, dangerous path I've gone on. And now I've built a few of these things, and I think it's just absolutely fascinating what you can do at that level. And I could talk more about it when we get to like how these things actually work.
Yeah.
But I just think it's magical, you know, these things that just don't have any code, but they're all working through these, extremely well-timed 5-volt pulses, all working in symphony with each other. And it's super cool.
Super you have cool. The forbidden knowledge now.
Yeah. You can call it that.
Very few people alive who know how these things work. So you may be like, we need to guard your life.
You know, it's funny you say that, because it's one of those things where, like, you know, you think, like, oh, well, if I can do it, it can't possibly be that special. Like if I could do it, then surely anybody could do this. Right?
Well, I think you guys could do this. They would have to be interested in it.
That's that is the stumbling block.
Yeah. All right.
But, hey, maybe someone will hear our conversation and also think, oh, this sounds rad. I want to mess around with TTL.
You know, there is one other guy who is in our Gaming Alexandria Discord, and he is actually not too far away from where my in-laws live. So next time I go out that way, out to Northwest Indiana, we're gonna hang out. We're gonna have a good time.
There you go.
You'll have 2/3 of the world's TTL arcade game knowledge in one place. You get together with Ed Fries.
Yes, at least
the triumvirate will be complete.
At least 2/3 of them under the age of 50. Put it that way. But most of the other guys are kind of getting up there. Yeah. If somebody hears this and wants to join in our madness, please.
For the love of God.
Yeah. I need somebody to talk to about this stuff who isn't my very patient wife, who's very supportive, you know. But, you know, there comes a time when she just says, like, I cannot remember what I had for breakfast, but I know about these cascading counters that you've been working on. Like, anyway.
Yeah. And as for me, so obviously I was born 83. Well after the heyday for these games, like obviously. I said earlier. Around 92 or so, I remember finding a book at the library. I've mentioned it before, but it was Craig Kubey's Winner's Book of Video Games. And he has a chapter in there where he just sort of talks about some of the older games from before the Golden Age, because his book came out in like 82. That you can still find in arcades. So he's talking about a lot of 70s games. He talks about, like, Computer Space and Pong and Space Wars and a few others off the top of my head I can't remember. But I remember finding that really intriguing. And then a few years after that, I remember going to Cedar Point in Ohio. I think it was, like, a school trip or something. And they had a little arcade in there at the time. I guess a big arcade, really. And it clearly hadn't been updated in years because it was full of machines from the 70s, both video games and some of the electromechanical machines, which I spent a good chunk of time in there and quarters.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's where I got to first play Space Invaders and Atari's Tank or...
Key Games.
Key Games Tank, yes.
Yeah.
Very technically not the same company, but really.
No.
We all know. And yeah, a handful of others. And I thought they were really cool. And that's also when I first realized, like, oh, these early Atari 2600 games, these are just home ports of these 1970s games that I can actually play.
Yes.
So that sort of put me down a rabbit hole. And I've gotten to play a few more over the years. I've gotten to play Pong and Computer Space at, like, gaming events and... A couple of these have FPGA recreations, so I can play them on the Mister. I think a couple have been redone in emulation on MAME, but there's only a handful of these 70s games I've really gotten to play with. But I've seen like footage, I've talked to people who played them and or have written about them, and they're really really cool. And it's very interesting to see how they sort of worked around the extreme limits of what they had to work with at the time, both before and after, microprocessors just started getting introduced into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, someone told me I should dress for the job I want. But the job I wanted was talking about video games, and let's be honest, I aged out of the video games podcaster uniform of logo tees and blue jeans a long time ago. But the thing about dressing nicely is that it's hard to find dress pants that look sharp but also feel comfortable without spending a lot of money. Thankfully, this holiday season, a little star shone its light to lead me to a true miracle. Dealmaker pants by Public Rec, which look great, feel great, and will make your CPA say great as well. Now, our sponsors want me to tell you about how awesome these trousers are for hitting the golf course, but let's be honest, we all know that the only golf I ever play has a T&E Soft logo on the title screen. These trousers deserve more authentic praise than me bragging about their fit on the back nine. They're made in a crisp five-pocket style that's suited for more than just recording chats about video games, but still comfortable, breathable, and durable enough for those long, grueling studio recording sessions. And I can definitely vouch for the fact that they look damn good with either a pressed shirt and dressy jacket or a more casual sweater look. And now is a great time to upgrade your wardrobe with something like the Dealmaker, because Public Rec is running their biggest sale of the year. For a very limited time, you can get 25% off your entire order at publicrec.com, whether that's Dealmaker pants or something else. I picked up a waffle knit hooded sweatshirt that genuinely turned out to be the nicest hoodie I've ever worn. Great fit, great materials, great cut. So stop suffering the indignity of lesser pants and give the gift of comfort this holiday. For a very limited time only, shop the holiday sale and get 25% off at publicrec.com/retro. That's publicrec.com/retro to unlock the best savings of the year. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them, so please support our show and tell them that Retronauts sent you. Give yourself or someone you love the gift of comfort this holiday. Upgrade your wardrobe instantly and save 25% off during the Public Rec holiday sale at publicrec.com/retro.
So, yeah, I think that's a good segue into talking a bit more about what makes these games so unique, both on a hardware level and even just like in terms of the cabinet design.
Mm. Oh, yes, a beautiful, like, 70s mid-century modern that like chrome trim, walnut wood grain everywhere. Oh my god, it's beautiful. It's a thing of beauty. I incorporate it into all my work. And they're all, you're right, they're all like different shapes. You know, Computer Space is like a fiberglass cabinet, right? And that was done a few times.
It's like very rounded.
Like in an attempt to make it like futuristic, like, right?
Nolan told me, I think Nolan Bushnell sculpted that shape out of clay and gave it to Ted Dabney, who hired a guy who did fiberglass hot tubs and swimming pools or whatever.
Nice.
And they had that fabricated from the, and there's a hole in the back so you could put the circuitry in it, you know, and the TV and everything. And then they put a wood board, I think, over the back of it. So it's fascinating. I was just thinking maybe we could mention like just the origin of this. It goes back to the origin of arcade video games, basically, with Computer Space. And the technological origin is basically, you know, in the 60s, first of all, Ralph Baer and his engineers at Sanders had discovered, you know, how to create signals on the screen and manipulate them. But they actually cheated. A lot of people don't know about this, but they used these Heathkit signal generators that made spots on the screen, spot generators. And so Ralph hacked up these spot generators and made it so you could control the spots. He never invented the circuitry to actually, you know, do this by itself. They just sort of borrowed it. And I'm sure that the other guys,
Bill Roush and what's the other guy?
Bill Harrison.
Bill Harrison.
I think Bill Harrison was his chief deputy on building these consoles. So he probably had to implement his own version of that. But, you know, at first Ralph was sort of like doing a hack. And so when it came to Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney in the late 60s, early 70s, around 70-ish, Nolan had played Space War, the mainframe arcade game created in 1962 era at MIT. And so he wanted to put a coin slot on it and turn it into an arcade game because he had worked at a Midway and knew about electromechanical arcade games, which predated this stuff. And they were not very reliable. They broke down a lot frequently. And he was in charge of a Midway that had a bunch of these old games that would break down all the time. And he, you know, when he saw this game on the mainframe, he's like, man, this would be a great arcade game. So he thought about, you know, they thought about using a computer called the Data General Nova, which was the cheapest computer at the time, but it wasn't powerful enough and it's still too expensive.
Say cheap and, in scare quotes.
Yeah.
Cheap as in, I can't like remember what it was, like 10 grand. 10 yeah. grand or, okay, it was, I just looked, it's $4,000, which was $24,600 in 2011. I don't know what that is. I'm looking at my inflation. I'm looking at my article from Technologizer. So at some point, you know, they put this idea aside, but months went by and then Bushnell asked Dabney, this is what Ted Dabney told me, a direct quote. He said, Nolan came to me one time and he said, on a TV set, when you turn the vertical hold on the TV, the picture will go up. And if you turn it the other way, it goes down. Why does it do that? I explained it to him. It was the difference between the sync and the picture timing. He said, could we do that with some control? I said, yeah, we probably can. And we'd have to do it digitally because analog would not be linear. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of his epiphany. It was like, hey, we could control that, you know, use the vertical hold and horizontal hold and stuff and make the signals around. And then so Ted created this spot generator circuitry himself and handed it over to Nolan, who developed the game logic. You know, some people believe he didn't develop the game logic. I personally do believe that he did, you know, 90% of it or something. And that's how it became what became computer space. So that this might segue well into, Nate, if you could describe that vertical and horizontal hold control and syncing and stuff like that, like how these games built up. Yeah.
So analog televisions worked at, we'll just keep it to the black and white to make it simpler, at about 60 cycles per second, right? 60 hertz. Mm-hmm. If you're doing interlaced video, you know, that's 30 hertz per frame and per interlaced frame. And the composite video signal, which is what was broadcast out to televisions at that time, is made up of these little pulses. And, you know, a TV will look to that and sync to that. And so, for instance, you have like the vertical sync pulse, which goes low, is about, I think, 27 microseconds. Is that right? Microseconds. Yeah.
Sounds right.
Like 27 microseconds. Then you have a horizontal sync pulse, which is like 4.7. And, you know, you can mix these signals together and it creates a raster image. And you can vary the signal going up or down. You know, if we do 1 volt peak to peak, that'd be, you know, all the way up to 1 volt is white. And at about 0.7-ish is black. And anything lower than that would be seen by the television circuitry as a sync signal. So knowing that, I mean, you know, one of the first things you do when you need to do stuff with electronics is you play with something called like a 555 timer, which is this really bog simple little chip that you can use to make like blinking lights or a little delay timer, you know, so, something kind of like that. But you can manipulate those signals and kind of play with them. For instance, what I believe, like what, for instance, what the Odyssey does and what those early Rolf Baer experiments do is they simply take the full field of video. They time out what that is. And then they use a timer, not a 555 timer, because they just use transistors and diodes, DTL logic, if you will. And, you know, can squeeze that or stretch it to be what they need. And taking those two things, when you have the horizontal and the vertical, you can mix those together with some simple logic and you got a little spot that you can move around. I hope that's not too technical, but, yeah. And so what you can do too, and what a lot of these games did, I'm not certain on computer space. I haven't looked at the schematic too much on that one, but what they will often do is they'll set up some logic to do like the little timing pulses for the horizontal and vertical sync. And then they'll figure out what is the, how much time they have to create video lines and have like a series of cascading, you know, 16 or 4-bit counters to count the lines on a TV screen. They do it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And you have these different frequencies that you can pull off of from these counters and mix them and match them and all that to make shapes and, you know, do all sorts of crazy stuff with them, whatever you want to do. And, yeah, it's a pretty genius way to do video games because, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than a Nova computer, which I think they wanted to like network, right? They wanted to have like four or five machines hooked up to the same computer. Was that the idea?
The one, what they told me was his idea was to do two off of one machine, just two terminals basically, but it wasn't powerful enough to play two at the same time. And so it was too expensive for just one game or something like that. And they just dropped the idea. So
yeah,
I'm gonna say the Galaxy game got, I guess, field tested or however you want to call it, quote unquote, released at Stanford. Mm-hmm. I think it was Stanford.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, that used a PDP-11, and you know that that financially made as much sense for them to make two units total. And I think they're both at the Computer History Museum now.
Oh boy,
or at least one of them is.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at like, this is like going off of like 1977, 1978 sale numbers when things were considerably cheaper, but the price really wasn't that different. You know, you can look at like old Radio Shack catalogs and you can see, you know, how much these things cost, these little, you know, generic logic chips. And, you know, like a 7400, which is it's NAND gates. You know, AND gates that are inverted at the output. And they were like a dollar for like five of them, you know? And so that's nothing especially compared to that. And the fact that you can just kind of hack into a black and white television and inject the composite signal directly into it. You don't have to futz with monitors, you know?
It's, Computer Space and Pong and some of the other early games just straight up used retail consumer black and white TVs. They just popped them in there and wired them up, which was probably the most, I guess the actual shell of the machine, probably more expensive. But I feel like internally, the monitor was probably just by a long shot the most expensive part of it.
Yeah, it could have been or close to it. And I bet, too, that they probably could find monitors that they got a good deal on.
Yeah.
I would have to assume. I mean, that's sort of what happened with Radio Shack, right? With their TRS-80 Model 1. Like, theirs were just sort of repurposed.
Yeah.
TV RCA. Shit. Yeah. Yeah.
I think what happened probably with the early arcade games was just, you know, when Nolan and Ted basically invented this new product category of the retail arcade, you know, video game, there were no monitors. There were security monitors that probably cost $10,000 a piece or something ridiculous, you know, and then there's television sets. And so there was no in between yet. But once there was a market for it in terms of arcades, people needing this, I'm sure some purpose-built monitors were created and sold to these companies, but I don't know who did that. And that's another little lost chapter of history. You know?
I know Wells Gardner was big into it in the early 80s and late 70s, but I don't remember off the top of my head who was the company that like first got into it. But I remember it was fairly early, like 74, 75.
Mm. Yeah. I seem to think maybe some Japanese company may have done it first.
Might have been.
I don't know. So maybe we should just describe Galaxy Game just for a minute, which is that, you know, in 71, before Computer Space came out in, I'd say, November of 71, something like that, in the summer, I think it was the summer of 71, a couple guys, Bill Pitts and Hugh Tuck, or is it Hugh Tuck and Bill Pitts? I can't remember. Those two guys, names interchanged. They created this game that Kevin mentioned that used a PDP-11/20, I think it was. And it was the first version, I think, it was a version of Space War, basically, first of all, the game from MIT that we mentioned earlier. Yeah. And it had a vector display, and they put a coin slot on it, and they put it in the Tresidder Student Union in Stanford, and they charged, I don't know, like 10 cents a game or something like that. And it was popular there at the union, but because of, you know, the cost involved, obviously they couldn't deploy these computers everywhere. So it never went any farther. They made a second version later that was like two games on one machine or multiple games. And it did beat, you know, Computer Space to market as the first coin operated video game, you know, technically, but it wasn't a commercial product that they sold as a product to others, you know, to make money. And yeah. So the first commercial arcade video game was Computer Space in November 1971. So there we go. Set the stage.
There you go. And if you want to play Galaxy Game, I mean, you just play Space War and pretend you're putting coins in.
There you go.
We've spent a long time building it up. Maybe we should talk about the games.
Yeah, the games themselves.
Anyone's still listening? I don't know.
So yeah. Some of these are really cool. And I think what makes them really interesting is just like the hardware design is really fascinating. Even beyond what we've talked about internally, we talked a little bit about Computer Space. But, you know, this was the era when electromechanical games were still king, at least early on. Mm-hmm. And they take a lot of cues from those, both in terms of where they'd be deployed or even, you know, where they could deploy these, where electromechanical machines could not actually fit. So you'd see them in like pool halls and bars and taverns, and bowling alleys, etc. But also they took some of those electromechanical visual cues. So one that I really like pointing out is it's a Ramtex baseball.
Yeah.
Which is one of the first coin-op games or video games, really, to have representations of, like, little people, which it does in TTL Logic. I think it might use a...
It uses a couple PROMs.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask, is that one diode-based, or did they actually have, like, a ROM for the graphical data? They did start doing that.
They have a little ROM. I think it holds about, like, 128 bytes. Like, it's not much, but it's plenty for, like, a little stick figure.
Yeah. But yeah. What makes it fascinating is that if you look at the machine in a picture, probably you're not going to actually see the machine. But because it has that, you know, overhead view that a lot of baseball games did at the time, so they mounted the monitor in such a way and built the cabinet in such a way that it looks like you're having a bird's eye view down at a baseball stadium. So, like, there's stadium seating surrounding the monitor. And that is, like, such a cool design. It did not work out very well for the machine, because the early ones were holding the monitor up with, like, material that could not support the weight, and they would just sort of collapse.
Yes.
But they look so cool up until that collapse.
Yeah. There were a couple others that did that, too. Like, Chicago Coin, I think, had a couple. Like, TV Goalie is one that does that. Where they kind of have like, yeah, that bird's eye view, looking at it like, I think like a soccer game is like the conceit. Of course, it's just like a Pong style game, but the conceit is soccer and you get to look down in on it. Like you're looking down on into a stadium. It's pretty cool.
Or Super Flipper. You mentioned Chicago Coin. So cool. They put out this game called Super Flipper, which was a video pinball machine. And they designed the cabinet to look like a pinball machine with like, you have the back glass and then you have the little play field and that's your like video screen. And you use the buttons on the side of the cabinet to like work your flippers.
Yes.
What year was that? Do you know?
75.
Okay. So Atari beat them because there was a game called
Ping Pong
in 1974 that I think was probably the first video pinball game.
I think it is. And it's super cool as well.
I would love to see that in person. It's a wild looking cabinet.
Do you count Exidy's TV pinball though?
I don't know.
Is that like,
when did that come out?
That was 74, late 73.
But that was more like a paddle.
It is.
Yeah.
Paddle. Oh yeah. I remember that.
But the idea was to like ape pinball.
Yeah.
The cool thing about Super Flipper is that it still uses electromechanical sounds. So it still uses like the bells of like an electromechanical pinball game.
That's cool.
Yeah. And it has like a back glass that lights up, you know?
Yeah. I wouldn't like it. I wouldn't even know how to begin to emulate that, but it looks so cool. If you like look up a video of these things, you can find video of a good chunk of like 70s games if you know what you're looking for.
Sure.
By the way, this reminds me, this is a weird story, but there was a guy who used to work at my dad's company named Dave. Can't remember his last name right now, but he worked for Midway or something. I can't remember now. And it was in the 70s. And when the 4004 chip came out, you know, in 72, he created one of the first microprocessor controlled. I don't know if it was a pinball game. There's like a bowling. I think it's Bally Alley. He worked on Bally Alley, and I thought that was really cool. It's an electromechanical bowling game. It's not a video game, but it was one of the first to have a microprocessor in it, really early.
Like a Shuffle Alley kind of thing?
I think you, probably have a ball and you roll it down, or a shuffle puck or something. I can't remember now, but I'd love to see that. That's my one little... the reason I bring that up is just because of what you mentioned, the hybrid nature of these early things where people are trying to figure out how to do these arcade games and what elements they should use. And so here I'm talking about the sort of the opposite of what you're talking about. You're talking about a video display with some electromechanical parts. And this was a electromechanical machine with a software logic for one of the first times that happened. And so there's this interesting hybrid period where these things are kind of mixing together these different technologies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's very like interesting to me trying to delineate like, okay, where does electromechanical end and video game begin? Because there are some real edge cases. There's like a skiing game that.
Yeah. Allied
Leisure Ski. And it is technically an electromechanical game.
Yes. It's made to look like a video game.
Yes, made to look like a video game. So, like, it's in a cabinet that looks like a video game. It has a screen, and it's like a projector screen that's, like, rolling through stuff that actually exists. But it's designed to look like the hot new thing, a video game, and they put it up in, like, ski lodges.
Yeah, so, there were a bunch of electromechanical games that used projection. You know, I think Atari even licensed one from Namco, like, called F1... or something in the 70s. I can't remember where. But it was like you sat down in a cabinet and saw the screen, you know, as a film of someone racing. Yeah. And somehow you could control it a little bit with a wheel. It was crazy. I'd love to play that. Like, what the hell happened to those?
Yeah.
That is an amazing lost piece of history right there. You know, like, man, people I would pay $1 million. If I had $1 million to just go see those in person. Like, if there was a room full of all the lost arcade games ever made, mechanical, video, whatever, like that would be so incredible. Anyway, that's my time machine wish.
That's a good one as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know some like of these 70s video games and EM games, like they're around. Like I think the Strong Museum has several. I think
they have ping pong.
Oh, no.
There. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
They don't have it on display right now, but they do have it.
Next time I go to Rochester, I'll have to bug them about it.
I need to go up there. I've been invited many times, but I never went just because it's so far. You know.
I know. It's super far for me. I only go once a month. It's hard.
There's also an arcade near Youngstown, Ohio, that has a bunch of electromechanical games. I've been meaning to
really
take a drive out there. I mean, it's several hours, so it's not an easy drive for but
Retronauts field trip is in order. Yep. On location in Youngstown. Yeah.
Well, you start in Rochester, and then you go to Youngstown, and then you go to Michigan for what's up there?
Marvin's Marvelous Mechanical Museum.
Yeah, there you go.
Then we'll go to San Francisco, the Musée Mécanique, which is at Fisherman's Wharf. I've been there 3 or 4 times. I don't know.
I've been there once, but I've been to Marvin's a ton of times because I used to live nearby and it was the only arcade worth going to for a couple of years there.
Yeah. My brother used to live in Youngstown. I'm mad that I didn't know about that while he lived there.
I think it's a recent development.
There's
a place in the Twin Cities or near the Twin Cities that has a bunch of electromechanical games. I've heard about that. Mm-hmm. I haven't been there, but heard it's good. Getting a little afield, but that's fine.
This
is that kind of podcast.
Yes. The Retronauts ancient arcade bucket list.
Listen, we're just telling people like where they can go to find 70s games because you can't really emulate most of these.
You can't download them. I mean, a lot of the schematics are on there, and you know, I guess you could build them off of that if you really wanted to. I wouldn't recommend it, but you can do it.
Find the queen without a king. They say she plays guitar and cries and sings. La la la. Ride a white mare in the footsteps of doom. Trying to find a woman who's never, never, never been born. Standing on the hill in the mountain of dreams. Telling myself it's not as hard, hard, hard as it seems.
Anyone listening this far into this podcast is part of a secret society.
Yeah, that's right.
A secret society of the TTL worshippers or whatever. You know, like there is such a niche upon a niche. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
We should probably talk about the games though. This is where Jeremy Parrish would smack me around and be like, <"I don't, laughs> go. We need a strong man in charge, Kevin.
Yeah. Listen, we're all a little punchy today. It's fine.
Someone needs to put a tent on this circus. It ain't going to be me, but somebody's got to.
But I was just going to say, like, you know, a lot of these aren't emulated or even simulated or, you know, remade in FPGA.
No.
And, you know, this was the 70s. They did not have high production runs. Like, Pong is a massive outlier. Most games got, like,
500.
A few hundred. Yeah, 500 or so. Yeah. Computer Space had 2000, and that was considered pretty successful for an arcade game. When your highs are Pong and like Breakout and Space Invaders, yeah, everything else looks like a failure, but they were all doing decently for themselves. They're just, you know, 50 years old and were, you know, wailed on at arcades because they were designed for that.
Yeah. Doesn't Space Invaders use an 8080 processor?
I believe it does.
Okay.
That should not be in this podcast. That's,
yeah.
But no, like, CPU is allowed.
But I was going to say, even like CPU based games, like even these are hard to come by, and there's quite a few that aren't really dumped, or they're, you know, dumped poorly because they were dumped in the 90s before people really knew what they were looking for.
And they do, even then, like they didn't necessarily always use like off the shelf graphic generators, video chips, you know.
They were using like a combination of like analog parts and the CPU parts. So like something like PT-109, which is in the running, is like one of the first potential CPU based video games ever made. That, or microprocessor based video games, that is undumped. I've not encountered anyone with a copy of that machine. So I don't know if it ever will be dumped. There's something like Spitfire, which was written by, or rather programmed by, Michael Glass, who went on to, you know, port it to the Channel F after the company he was working for went under. But that original arcade game, that's never been dumped. It's super rare because they didn't make very many before they went out of business. So it's like stuff like that.
There's a lot of fly-by-night companies like Mirko, Fun Games, Electra. Wow.
Electra had some really cool games too.
They sure did. Flying, there's footage on YouTube of one called Flying Fortress, and you might consider it one of the first shoot 'em ups. But it goes from right to left instead of the other way around. But you know, you go down, you bomb stuff, but it has these really cool sound effects of explosions and guns going off, you know, but it's all done in transistor logic, these TTL chips.
Yeah. I really like, there's a few games that used interesting technology to get around the limitations of, the sound capabilities at the time. So there's Fonz, based on Happy Days.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And because they, you know, couldn't very well emulate the sound of a motorcycle, they just slapped an 8-track in there that had that as, like, the audio. And I know a few places that have Fonz machines, like the Strong Museum has a Fonz machine. They do not have the tape. So even though you can technically play it, you're missing, like, a key component of the experience.
Right.
And then there's a Maneater from another fly-by-night company, Project Support Engineering, which had a tape deck that could play back the screams of divers as they're eaten by sharks. So, like, the game itself does have, like, sound effects, but, you know, they wanted to go all in on their Jaws craze. So.
Yeah. There was one of those at the Midwest Gaming Classic this year. It wasn't playable, but, I mean, that was plenty for me just to see it, just to see, like, oh, this game does exist. It's not just a photo on the internet. This is so cool, you know?
That's the one that's, like, shaped like a shark head, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Which is also amazing.
Oh, it's so cool. I mean, I wish it could work, but, it was just amazing just to see it for real. It's smaller than I thought it would be. It's not a very tall machine.
Yeah, sort of like what you were mentioning earlier. This is before standardized arcade cabinet designs, and so there's a wild variety. You just said Maneater was the one with the cassette tape.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And there's, what about, like, wasn't Tank, Key Games Tank, one of the first games to use ROM chips? I can't remember what it or
might be.
I know it used ROM chips. I feel like it was Grand Track 10 was the first one that I'm aware of.
For the track layout, right?
Yeah, I think it was for the track.
Yeah.
Speaking of Grand Track 10, it's one of the few that I've played.
I've never played it. So that's awesome.
They have one at, or maybe it's, it may be one of the variations, like Sprint or Super Sprint, I think they have a Grand Track 10 at the Musée Mécanique over at,
or Le Mans.
Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. I've played it. I think it's a Grand Track 10, but it's neat. So it's just an overhead, you know, the field is a bunch of dots, like the track is a bunch of dots, and your car can turn pretty smoothly with the wheel and the gas pedals make it go. And it's pretty nice thing to play considering how limited it is.
Yeah.
You know, Indy 500 on the Atari 2600 came with a driving controller. I don't know if you guys know that
game,
but it's a lot like that. And it's really neat how smooth and sort of analog the feel of the driving is, you know.
Because it's like a rotary encoder,
it's
right?
It's a rotary digital encoder, if I remember.
Yeah, it's rotary with no stops. There's no, you know, it just can rotate as much as you want. And it's a nice experience. It's something it's one of those unique little experiences in games that I've always craved that most people don't know and have never experienced. Mm. It's like what's the coolest, weirdest thing you can do on Atari 2600? I'd say get a Indy 500, play with the driving controller, or play Arkanoid on an NES with the Arkanoid controller, or play like, you know, Star Raiders with the Star Raiders controller.
The video touchpad.
Yeah, the video.
Or you could program BASIC on it, right?
Yeah, that's true. But now we got sidetracked. Sorry. We're talking about arcade games here.
We've driven off the course with Grand Track.
Fire Truck.
Oh.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, Fire Truck's a fun
one. Fire Truck is crazy. Yeah. Doesn't it have two screens or something? Or there's two people playing?
You have there's a two-player version, right?
Yes,
where, like, so you have someone driving in the front and then someone controlling the back of the engine.
Yeah, like a real fire truck. They have one at Galloping Ghost in Chicago, but the last time I went there, it was not working, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But
that's
a really cool game. I think I've seen it at Fun Spot as well up in New Hampshire.
That's another one the Strong has.
I think it was pretty popular for the time, you know, relatively speaking, but it's pretty cool. I was just thinking of how they had, like, you could see a very clear difference in how different countries approached racing games as their developers. Mm. So, like, Atari had these top-down games like Grand Track 10 and Sprint and Indy 800. And then in Japan, you had, like, these racing games that were more focused on your vehicle and you were sort of driving along a track that would come down the pipe at you. So you had stuff like, you know, Fonz, which was originally Speed Race.
something like
Wheels. Speed Race became Wheels in the U.S. Wheels. And Fonz was something else.
Yeah.
And yeah, they take different approaches to like imitating the sort of speed and momentum of driving.
Mm-hmm. And then there was the one in Germany.
Yes.
Yes. Nürburgring. Is that how you say it?
Nürburgring 1. I don't know. Someone who's German will probably get mad at us for mangling the pronunciation. But like, so that's a game that is, that's like, not only is it TTL, but it used something like 28 boards.
25
boards.
Yeah.
It's a lot of boards.
Yeah.
There's a picture of it online. You can see it's not very good quality, but you can see it. You can see that the cage, you know, with all the TTL cards on it, just filled with chips.
Yeah, there's like two or three of these machines still like floating around in Europe. I'll probably never see one in person, but it was very interesting because the developer of it was Dr. Rainier Forst, who was very interested in driving simulators and thought video games, like specifically the TTL technology that Pong used, would be really good for that versus, you know, a projector, oscilloscope arrangement. So he designed this machine, and like, it was a hugely popular when he debuted it. And problem is that he used so many circuit boards, and he was practically a tiny little operation that he could not fill all of those, which means that someone else did. Started off with Digital Games. One of their people saw the machine while he was in there. Ted Michon, he went to West Germany to fix a defective shipment of their game Air Combat. He saw Nürburgring at the same time Forst was there, like, giving a demonstration to some kids. So he got to learn how the machine worked, and he went home and made his own version of it.
Cool.
But because Micronetics was tiny and didn't have much capacity either, they relicensed that out to Midway and, I believe, Atari.
Mm.
So that's where you got 280 Zap and Night Driver.
Yeah.
And Micronetic's own version, which I forget off the top of my head what it was called. Night Racer.
I didn't know that the Nürburgring connection was that close. That's cool.
Yeah. So
it is cool.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, it's like a game that exists by pure luck, like Night Driver and whatnot. And if you've ever played any of those games, they are first-person driving games, which big successful genre nowadays, very hardcore fans of it. And they got its start with this TTL era gaming. Mm-hmm. And with a couple of games that I'm pretty sure are also not emulated, because Night Driver was a TTL game.
I've always wanted to play the original arcade Night Driver. I don't think I have. You know, I've obviously played the 2600 version since I was a kid. I loved that game. It's just, that's so funny how you can be enthralled by a bunch of little dots like moving around on the screen, and you feel like you're driving a car. It's wild.
Yeah.
The 80s, we were happy.
I've gotten to play Night Driver a couple times. I've been to a couple arcades that have had it working.
Yeah.
And it's very cool because, you know, the dots are moving around, and you have like the gear shift and the wheel and pedal and all that fun stuff. But there's no like image of your car on screen.
It's a decal.
They have a decal on the cabinet to show where you are, like, physically located. And if one of the lines on the road gets too close to your decal, you like crash and stop and have to restart moving. It's such a cool arrangement.
What year was Night Driver? I'm looking for
76, I think.
76. Okay. I have a bunch of Atari flyers in folders by year, luckily, because I did a slideshow once, and I'm like, I have like every game. Night Driver. Yeah, I see that. That's cool. It has a decal. See, the overlay and decal thing is another one of those hacks, you know, that a lot of early arcade games did, because they had black and white screens, and sometimes they needed a graphical element that was far beyond the resolution of ever being able to display on screen or something color, you know, so they would use an overlay transparency on the screen.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, I think I saw one, you mentioned the baseball game that has like the stadium. I'm sure that's like, you know, not on the display itself, but I mean, not generated in video.
No, it's, you know, physically around there. Yeah.
Yeah. And this Outlaw, I'm looking at man, Atari Outlaw, I've never, this is crazy.
It's a very weird looking game.
Yeah, it has an overlay with of like a Old West town.
On not the not the 2600 game, right?
No, no. This is an arcade game. There's so many weird arcade, like Atari games that no one's ever heard of.
Yeah.
There's one called Cops and Robbers that I've never, what the hell is this? This is like four people play. This is from 76. There's like four joystick looking things and wheel. I don't know what. There's pedals, foot pedals. And
Outlaw's a light gun game.
Yeah, Outlaw has a light gun stunt cycle.
Yeah,
Stunt Cycle's cool one. Fun. I've gotten to play that one at Galloping Ghost.
That's a fun one.
Go through, why don't I just read these like while I'm looking at them? Let's go back to 73 just real quick. I mean, we mentioned Gotcha in 73, which I think did we like it's sort of a chase game and it had the weird dome, pink dome controllers for a limited time.
Yes,
that game's interesting to me, both because it's one of the first color games. They had a variant of it that they only made like a couple dozen copies of that were cut in color, but also because if I remember right. I think Al Alcorn described it existing because of like a glitch with the one of the Pong machines that they were trying to figure out. And he realized like, I can use this to like generate a maze. I could make a game around that. And
I'll bet
that's where you got Gotcha.
Yeah, that's clever.
I could see that. I'll bet it had to do with the score. Like being repeated, like parts of the score being repeated over the screen. Cause you kind of have to, and I'm not going to get too technical again here, but basically you create the score by like using one of those things that drive 7-segment displays, you know, for numbers. But instead of like wiring it to lights, when you use the decoder, you wire it to like frequencies of the television. And you get the little outs, but, you get the number output. It's a really easy way to do it. And, but you have to window it. You have to, otherwise it'll like repeat all over the screen. So yeah, I could totally see that. Oh, that's so cool. I love that.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen it in action, but it is like a very visually arresting game to see. Just like, cause I feel like that's sort of true of a lot of TTL games. The in motion, they don't look like a video game like you generally think of it.
It's not frames of animation. It's completely smooth, right?
Yeah, it's weirdly smooth, and I can understand why they kept using it up until like 1980 or so, I think, is when Sega's Monaco GP came out, because like I've gotten to play that before at a New Jersey arcade, and it's just like so cool to watch the track just like smoothly shift in size, and like you're entering a tunnel, and it just all like works so well, and that's wild.
Man, I want to play that. There's something about the aesthetics of this that's really fascinating too. Like I was describing an experience you can't get anywhere else. Kind of is this is like on a real CRT with the real chips and the real thing is something that's will never be perfectly simulated. You could probably do a pretty good job with enough resolution and everything, but it's an experience unto itself. The phosphor glow.
So
let's go back to the like Space Race. I skipped Space Race. I think that was Atari's second game, right? After
that
Pong.
That sounds right. Yeah.
You know, there's two players, they're going vertically, they're avoiding things. They're like avoiding stars or something. I don't know. I've never played that. There's Pong doubles, which is doubles, four people, two on two. Then in 74, things start to explode. We've got World Cup football, which is European, like, multiplayer Pong. Grand Track 10 was 74. It's just one player. Grand Track 20 was 74, too. That's two players. Pin Pong, we already talked about. Quadra Pong, which is a really neat machine. It has four players. But they're, which, you know, person is guarding a sort of hole on the sides of four sides of the screen, kind of.
But not the first four-player Pong game, because that's a tennis tourney from Allied Leisure.
Oh,
God.
Which I think was just like 2-on-2.
That game. I fixed one of those not that long ago. The fun thing about that game is that, well, Paddle Battle was the main one, right, that Allied Leisure did. That was their big Pong clone.
Yeah.
That I think for a long time, didn't they sell like more of that sold than Atari's actual Pong?
I believe so, because they had more capacity to like produce cabinets than Atari did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is almost exactly the same game. Like, it's the same chips and everything. But my board, I through Gaming Alexandria, I was able to procure about 10 or so TTL boards to see if we can get them working. Currently working on Ramtech Baseball. It's slow going, but, you know, we'll get there someday and we'll have footage on YouTube, streamed, you know, captured footage, but you know, we'll get there when we come to it. Anyway, so this Paddle Battle game, and I was looking at the schematics for it, and I noticed like things didn't like add up, but there was Paddle Battle on the board, like emblazoned under the solder mask, you know, there it is, Paddle Battle. And I keep working on it and like, something's not right. Like the edge connector for the, you know, hookups for like TV and, controls and all that. There's too many pins on this than there are in the schematic. Like, and, come to find out later on, you know, I did some digging and like, oh, they released a four-play version called Tennis Tourney, and that's what this board is. And so then after, you know, we figured that out, it was just, you know, balancing the analog signals, which is a whole other thing, which we can go into when we talk about
Bob's your uncle at that point.
Challenges. Well, depends on the game and the manufacturer. We could talk about that more when we get into like the challenges of preservation, but
there's way more games than we could talk about in one episode. I'm just looking at, like,
oh yeah,
I probably got to go soon.
Yeah. Like, well, and you're just talking about like the Atari stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking like, I'll just rattle off a couple names. We don't even have to talk about them.
Yeah,
like,
go for it.
Quack.
Yeah.
74 is a light gun game. That might be worth talking about, but, Rebound is a basketball game. Super Pong. There's something called, Elimination by Key Games. That might be a version of Pong something.
That yeah, sounds probably, right.
I believe it is.
It's like Quadripong. Spike is a volleyball, Key Games volleyball. Formula K is Key Games, Sprint, Super Sprint or something, or not Super Sprint, but Grand Track 10. And 75, things start getting more interesting. There's something called Anti-Aircraft by Atari, where two people are shooting.
It's Air-Sea Battle, if anyone's played that. Battle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crash and Score, which is like a demolition derby. I would love to play that.
That's on the Atari 2600 Indy 500 cartridge. They ported it on there as an extra game. Yeah.
Okay.
They did.
There's Highway, which is an overhead driving thing that had a cockpit. I think it may have been Atari's first cockpit video game. There was a cockpit electromechanical that I mentioned, the video, the F1, whatever it was called. But Jet Fighter, that's like one of the combat games, basically, from the combat cartridge. They had a game called Jaws. It's about
Shark Jaws.
Shark Jaws.
The shark's in shark very small print.
Sorry, yeah. Shark Jaws.
Yeah.
Steeplechase, horse racing, Pursuit, which is looks like another plane type game, but first person maybe. Combat. That's amazing.
Yeah.
We've got Tank. We mentioned that at Key Games. Going to 76, we've got, of course, Breakout, which was, I could talk for a minute about the origins of Breakout.
We did a Breakout episode a while ago. We delved into that a fair bit.
But if you want to dig into it more. Tell you himself about how it got created.
He did not tell me personally, no. Yeah. So
I'll just briefly mention that I think, until I interviewed Woz in 2007 and talked to him about video games, very few people knew that he designed one version of Breakout for the arcade. And I asked Alcorn later, you know, Woz says that, you know, it was Steve Jobs' project, you know, it was assigned to him. And Nolan Bushnell told me it was his idea or something to design the game. I don't know if that's true. And he assigned it to Steve Jobs. And Steve got his friend Woz to build it, of course. And there's all these famous stories about it. But so I guess people did know, but people didn't know that Woz thought it was the version that was released. That's what people didn't know.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Al Alcorn said, no, I mean, there's no way we would have released this thing. It had like weird, like five chips and no one understood how it worked. And, you know, like,
if I remember, it didn't have sound effects and like the scoring was like analog using a digital count or not a digital counter, like a counter outside the game. And they're like, yeah, this is not workable.
Yeah, so I don't know who designed the final version of Breakout, but it has that weird, cool little story. So I'm sure you talked about it in the episode. And I couldn't break Woz's heart and tell him, like, no, man, it wasn't your version. He still swears to this day that it was the version that was released and all this stuff. So
bless him.
Bless him.
Flyball, which is some kind of arcade baseball game by Atari. We mentioned this Cops and Robbers game is wild. Somebody's got to look into this. It's some four player, like it's got Tommy guns and Model T people, cops nice. And robbers.
Like Maze Craze.
Facing off, shooting each other. It looks kind of like Spy Hunter from overhead, but with four cars. And
it's wild.
And we've mentioned Night Driver. That was in 76. Outlaw, we mentioned that. Sprint 2. Looks like another version of Grand Track 2, Grand Track 20, sorry, 77, Canyon Bomber, which is a 2600 game, isn't it?
I got it ported directly.
Yeah.
Very faithful.
By David Crane, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a great game. Sprint 4 is four players, probably, that's not key, it's Atari, that's neat.
I think Sprint 4 might actually be an MPU-based game, microprocessor as well.
So we're getting into the microprocessors.
Yeah.
Sprint 8 is an eight-player game, sort of like Indy 800, which is a wild... Speaking of weird experiences, like I'd love to play eight players playing an overhead Indy 800 at the same time.
That'd be fun.
Like, that would be wild.
I've seen a video of that on YouTube, and it does look absolutely wild. Just like a whole family playing Indy 800 at some location in, I think, Italy.
Hmm.
Yeah, and how about Starship 1? That's probably microprocessor-based, right? This is sort of like...
So Starship on the 2600 is a port of it, but what's interesting is that Starship 1 came out like a month or two before the 2600 port, so Bob Whitehead must have like just been like looking over the shoulder while they were building that game out. Just like, all right, taking notes.
Yep, and so we're getting into like this, you know, there's some games called Triple Hunt, Superbug.
Superbug's cute.
78 has Football, which was a pretty famous game. It was a trackball, so that's microprocessor based.
That's an MPU. I think Atari at that point had fully gotten out of the TTL. I mean, not that they didn't incorporate TTL elements. I mean, a lot of arcade games still did up until the early 80s.
But TTL was much more failure prone and more expensive to like build out, and you couldn't just like design a basic hardware standard and like tweak it as you needed. You have to like redesign the hardware from the ground up every single game,
right? And it wasn't the main driver of the game at that point. Like TTL would be used for things like sound, graphics, if they didn't use a dedicated video processor, you know, things like that.
Like, yeah, this was an era where, like, Sega got really big into video games, like, head-on. It's a microprocessor game, but, like, that was a huge hit for Sega.
Head-on had some kind of port on the 2600. What was it called?
Dodge'em.
Dodge'em, yeah. It was like a clone.
It got cloned to, like, everywhere because it was such a huge hit, especially in Japan, I know.
Exidy had one. Crash?
Yeah, Exidy had Crash. Exidy had Death Race, which is like one of the first controversial games.
Oh, and that's full TTL.
That's full TTL, and it's super cool to actually like sit down and play.
Yep.
Death Race, they have one of those in San Francisco at the Musée Mécanique at the dock.
The Galloping Ghost has that one, too.
Galloping Ghost does have that one.
Death Race. That's one of the earliest games I've played.
Yeah. Your friend and mine, Ethan Johnson, and I played that when I went to visit him and when I visited in Chicago, and we spent a day at Galloping Ghost hitting up all the weird old arcade games we could find.
I enjoy that Exidy like reworked Death Race into Score, which is probably the first game with an animated woman, but we don't know for sure because, surprise, it is unpreserved, and the only couple, I know, historian Kate Willard's been like trying to track it down, and she's come across like three units and none of them work.
Oh, wow.
So, who knows? Who knows for sure if it's an animated woman, but it's like, the concept is like Death Race, except you're like chasing people around to, you know, score, quote unquote. But it's sort of like equal opportunity horny, I think, is the best way to describe it. Because, like, you're not necessarily chasing women, and like, the women can chase men. I'm not positive entirely at how it works, because it doesn't exist in any sort of playable way. But it sounds interesting.
The interesting thing, you're talking about Space Invaders and how, like, you know, that sort of is where, like, the line begins to blur a bit as they get to more CPU stuff. You know, while it did use an 8080, it still had TTL stuff. But Sega did make a full TTL clone of Space Invaders called Senken Yamato.
Which is insane that they bothered with this.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine. One of the silly little games that I built, Stormtrooper Attack, is sort of a Space Invaders-ish sort of thing, but it's just like one row of squares that you got to shoot. But to do like all of that, and they have like full alien figures and everything, like that thing's got to be like two boards at least.
at least.
There's so much into these cool games.
Yeah,
I want to play them all.
I want to play Drop Zone 4 because it's like one was from was that Electra or was that one Meadow Games?
No. Yeah.
So the concept there is you're like dropping bombs on targets, but it had like an anti-war Easter egg in there. So if you drop all your bombs and none of them hit a target, you get a free game.
Wow,
love it.
It's such a like cute little idea for your war game.
Yeah.
To make it, you know, not a war game.
And something else too, you know, we were mentioning like the interesting like cabinet designs and how they kind of went all over the place, but there was like one area where they really like stuck to a certain aesthetic, and that is absolutely those cocktail table games. You know, because they want to like sell them to be like, oh, this is for the lounge area, you know? And so like there's just these simple, handsome wood grain tables, you know, for things like Flim Flam from Meadow Games had that with like a little like miniature, analog joystick. So you could move along both the X, your paddle could go up and down the X and Y axis. So there was like that uniform factor there with those cocktail tables. And it's very funny that the way you look at some of the flyers for them, and it's like guys in leisure suits and girls with like these giant bell bottoms and done in these beautiful like watercolor paintings of like, yes, we're going to talk about our new Plymouth Roadrunners and play some Flim Flam.
As you do.
Right. And drink some cognac. Sure. Anyways, but, and there's a lot of interesting Pong clones too. Like Digital Games had one that's intrigued me for a while called Knockout. So like, instead of, you know, just trying to get the ball past the other player, each player has like a row of breakout style bricks behind them. This is of course pre-breakout, and the book, you have to hit the other player's bricks to win a point. And that's very interesting, and I would love to play that.
Yeah, really like playing with the sort of the premises on a lot of these, which is really cool.
Yeah, a lot of playing around. I mean, that's kind of like what like clean sweep is, right? Like, you know, here's a paddle game. What else can you do with paddles? Collect dots. You talked about that in your breakout episode, but
yeah, strangely influential clean sweep.
Yeah, and like Exidy's TV Pinball, which is sort of like a game that Ramtech developed but never released called Knockout, but Ramtech and Exidy are kind of the same thing.
They had a lot of the same personnel, I think what happened is they probably just licensed it or sold it or something.
Like Howl Ivy?
Because, like, a lot of these companies, like, they were, you know, straight up, like, pirated clones of games, but there's some very, like, murky licensing arrangements and sub-licensing.
Yes.
And that crossed over oceans, too. I just watched a video uploaded from, I think the account's Onion Software on YouTube.
Yeah.
But it's this Japanese, game historian. And there was a Taito event a couple weeks ago, as of this recording, where they were showing off a bunch of, like, their early 70s video games. And he was there with Tomohiro Nishikado, who helped design Space Invaders. And they were going through them all, and they had a copy of Ramtech's Clean Sweep, but it was a version that Taito had published.
Oh, my.
Because they had licensed it, and there was a couple other games from Ramtech, and I think Midway that they were showing off as well.
I need to.
So it was cool.
Bookmark this.
Tornado Baseball. That was the other one. Midway's like a microprocessor based.
Yes.
Sequel, if you will, to Ramtech's Baseball, which they had licensed for themselves
and released unchanged as Ballpark.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can play Tornado Baseball on the Bally Professional Arcade console.
You sure can.
I have an Astrocade, but it doesn't work. I just never got it working.
So, Ben Jedwards had to take off for the rest of this podcast, so we are moving along with me and Nate, and we will include his, where you can find him at the end of the video. We'll include his plugs at the end of the podcast. It's getting very late here.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wanted to talk a bit about sort of the preservation status of these games. We've talked about a lot of, like, really cool ones and what makes them interesting.
Yeah.
There's still a lot we haven't touched on, but we only have so much time.
Right.
Got to cut it off somewhere.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you can go on. And one more thing I want to touch on too, before we talk about the preservation challenges, is that a lot of these games are still very fun to play.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, Breakout's still great. Like it still grabs you. Death Race is a blast.
Clowns is great. Circus, like the little ping-ponging clowns bouncing up to balloons, which got ported around to everything.
That game's excellent. On the 2600, I'll play that for an hour until I get a score I'm satisfied with.
My personal favorite, Dog Patch from Midway, which is the best way I can describe it is like, what if you played volleyball with guns? It was the inspiration of the recent game Hyper Gunsport, which is just that. Because I think it was Brandon Sheffield and Frank Cifaldi were playing this Midway arcade game at the California Extreme some years ago. And Brandon's like, oh, that's cool. I'm going to make that again.
It's still influencing people, these old video games. But they are they pose a challenge. I mean, first and foremost, simply because these aren't software. You're not running any code.
Yeah, a lot of them aren't software, period. So
no, nothing.
You're talking about circuits that you have to implement into an FPGA, which, you know, that's kind of what FPGAs are good at.
It's doable.
Or you have to make it work through software using like soft lists, I think they're called.
I mean, there's ways to do it. And at that point, you're sort of simulating and you're really going for like the feel, like really trying hard to nail the feel. FPGA, though, will more accurately than anything else we have at this point, will get you what the actual circuitry is and does. Yeah. So that's a challenge. But FPGAs can be worked with, especially if you have schematics handy and a good high quality picture of the board, you know.
And ideally someone who can like play test it and make sure that it's lined up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Make sure you got it accurate.
Right. Right. Cause that can happen. And especially because oftentimes these schematics will have errors in them. And, you know, having the board, a good high quality picture of the board handy can help you look at the trace exactly. So you could say, okay, that's why this isn't working. Yada, yada, yada. And which can be a little daunting if you're like me and doing this for some reason. And you have, Ramtec Baseball, you know, and that's, two boards, two big, big boards. How big would you say? They're like poster sized, right?
Yeah, somewhere
and
around there.
It was small poster size, like whatever you would call that, 18 by 11 and a half, something like that, right?
11 by 17.
That's it, 11 by 17. And they each have about 100 chips on them. So, you know, that's a lot of work. But yeah, having the schematics and pictures handy is very nice. There are some, I have one, it's from Digital Games. It is one of their like Pong compilations. They had, some companies did this where you could play like a few variants of Pong on them. And, one of the things that they did to combat people copying their games is, Atari's was a little bit more clever. Cause they would do like the ROMs, right? They would give the ROMs the same nomenclature as the 7400 series logic. So it would like confuse people trying to rip off their game designs. Less clever in the case of Digital Games is they just scratched off the label of every single chip. So like, cool. I can't have do fun. Anything with this. Like, I mean, I do have, I have a cheap EEPROM burner. But one of the things it can do is it can identify logic chips. So I could desolder each and every single one of those chips and put the each and every one in there and see what they are. Of course, this doesn't take into account what happens if, you know, it doesn't work and it can't identify it. And then you're just kind of screwed. And for a lot of these lower run games that we have, the schematics are just not out there, you know. I mean, for Atari, they've been on there since the 90s. Not
pretty good quality for some of them.
Yeah. The quality is pretty trash for a lot of them, but that's getting rectified too at this point. It's getting better. But yeah, for some of the smaller run ones, you're just kind of SOL. And yeah, that's a big problem. Again, errors in schematics can make things kind of a nightmare. When I do those TTL builds from that book about building your own at home, every single one of the schematics, every single one had an error in it. Some of them less egregious than others. Sometimes it was just the pinouts being incorrect, which is, you know, I can work with that. And you could just sort of match up the data sheet of the chip with what's in the schematic and be like, oh, that got mixed up. I see what happened. That's not that big of a deal. The bigger problem is when there's like a mistake in the actual like routing of the logic. And that is so hard to suss out. And luckily for the book that I'm working on, every single one of these builds has a circuit description. So you can look in and see like, okay, so when he designed it, this is what he was trying to do. And so when I hear like what he's trying to do and what is actually happening on the board is I could weigh it against each other and I could say like, okay, there's actually supposed to be an OR gate in here that's supposed to go in between these two things instead of anding.
Where did he draw this up the wrong way?
Right, right. And in some cases, like sometimes I wish I could talk to the man who wrote it, David L. Heiserman. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2020, so I'll never know. But I get the feeling that he designed these things, that these were all just ideas and he never actually built any of them himself. I do believe that.
You might be one of a handful of people who ever has.
Yeah. I mean, there's one other guy I found, one, and he only built one game. It was one of the simpler ones, but he did do it.
What are you up to now? Like three?
Three. And I've started slowly on another one that uses slipping counters, which is... You think I would have had it hard enough with the pinball game, but...
You're making a face, so I think... It's not a great time.
No, it's hard. I mean, it feels so good when you get it working. Like, I think the first time when I got the video generator board working, like, I was so excited. I took my son, who I think was four or five, and I, like, airplane spun him around my head because I was just so thrilled that, like, I figured it out. But, and that can be a real headache. And another thing that's a problem too with keeping these boards going is that there are different versions of these 7400 series logic chips, and they each work a little bit differently. You have LS, HC, and HCT. And I mean, that's just for starters. And they work a little bit different. I won't get bogged down with details. This is not the kind of podcast this is. So I want to respect the people who are trudging through this part. But there are other like weird ones. Like, so LS was sort of like the first big leap from just plain old 7400, and it was a lot more power efficient. But like each brand sort of had like their own weird version. Like Fairchild had the F series, so 74F00. And because these things, the timing is just a little different. So, you know, you're supposed to be using this logic to, I don't know, put together a aircraft figure or a spaceship. And it doesn't look right. It's like wigging out, you know, and it's like spreading across the screen. You feel like, why is that? It's like, oh, because I need to use the C variant of this chip, and I substituted an LS chip, which was period appropriate, but not for this specific use case. And so because of that, that can be a real headache.
And, you know, I'll just magnify that for multiple boards for something like Indy 800 or Nürburgring 1 or
You
have to deal with all that for all these boards. And, you know, there are people who probably love that challenge. Clearly you do.
Yeah, I do. I do, honestly. You know, it sounds like, you know, I'm complaining here, but I do think it's very interesting. And something I do to kind of keep pushing myself forward is, you know, is as long as I learned something new, if I did that or I fixed a single issue, if I could do that in a section in a period of time where I'm working on a board and I have to leave it, if I've learned something or if I've been able to repair one element, then I've chosen to take that as a victory. And when you take that approach, I think it becomes much more enjoyable. And then your mind starts to reel about like, you know, I wonder what else you could do with this. Like, you know, like what if I made one? Like, what would that be? You know,
now you're designing like it's 1973.
I have this hobby computer sitting next to me as a quick tangent that's somebody designed a couple years ago. Actually, not that long ago, like last year. And it's a fully TTL computer using about 60 logic chips. It has like 640 by 480 VGA output, one color, of course, you know, white, but still, it's pretty cool. And, you know, as I get into it, I'm like, you know, but what if I used TTL logic and some 555 timers to turn the VGA output into composite output? And if I did that, then I could use the weird NTSC color encoding and make color.
So what you're saying is the next Rochester Maker Fair, you're going to have a very strange, like, unique computer.
I have been to the Maker Fair a couple times.
That would be very 70s, you know, when people were just designing their own computers.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's another thing entirely. But
yeah,
it is very interesting. And then, you know, you can look it up with your oscilloscope and you can kind of see how all the timing works and how the things go. You know, when this pulse goes up, then this one goes down for two cycles, and you can actually hook up your oscilloscope and see it in action. And to me personally, that's very thrilling. Your mileage may vary, but for me, it's pretty cool. I'll get on my feet. Most of the time Yeah, but those are just some of the challenges, and there are others. Like I said, I'm forgetting his real name. His username is Dillweed, and you can see some of his stuff on YouTube, and you can see some of the stuff that he's working on, and it's very cool. So shout out to him. He's like the other guy under the age of 50 who does this stuff.
So like this is very like, you know, a lot of emulation of old video games is very much based on like what are people interested in. And it makes sense.
Yeah. 'Cause
if you don't care about, I don't know, the Dick Smith wizard, then why would you bother writing an emulator for it?
Right.
And I think that's a big issue that a lot of these games have because, you know, a lot of them have these very small production runs. A lot of them were... Yes. Destroyed in like the 80s and 90s because
yes.
There was no real like market or aftermarket value for them. You know, God, if I had been collecting arcade machines in the 90s, you could have picked these up for a song. You know, I know a friend whose dad used to deal in arcade machines. I think he might still. And he's mentioned that, like, yeah, in the 90s, you couldn't give these things away. We had, like, a warehouse full of 70s machines that I wish we still had.
They were less than worthless.
Yeah.
They absolutely destroyed them.
So there's not very many of these around anymore. A lot of them are in private collector hands. And,
yeah.
Like, that's a whole other, like, scene that,
yeah.
For the most part, is not necessarily even online. A lot of these people, like, just know each other through, you know, old-time messaging systems.
Right. And if they are online at all, it's through like some sort of quasi Usenet style of thing.
Yeah. And there's a Facebook group for Bronze Age arcade
yes.
games. And I feel like that yes. only has like a small number of the people who are overall there.
Yeah. There's a Discord too, but that's like, seriously, it can't be more than 40 members on that Discord.
So like, yeah, you have this very like niche number of people who are interested and they don't necessarily have the right skill set to like translate these into something
right.
software emulatable or through FPGA.
Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of people doing that. Like
a guy
who goes by the name of Jimmy Stones, who yes. I think you know about.
Yeah. He's a Mr. Developer and he's got several projects that are mm-hmm. like TTL based in varying stages of completion, but even he's run into the dilemma of, okay, are these schematics accurate to the machine?
Right.
Where can I find like video footage of it running or like images of the boards? And like, so I know he has several that are near ready to release, but he hasn't mm-hmm. released them because he's not sure if they're actually accurate yet. So he's trying to get that information together.
I think Clean Sweep is one of the ones he's working on.
Clean Sweep was one of them. He sent me a list a while ago. Yeah. It's pretty extensive. But
does he have a Patreon?
I don't think so. Maybe he should.
If he does, that should be. If he does, that should be plugged.
He can be the Jotego or Hotego. I don't know.
Yeah,
he's Spanish.
Yes,
but
he
can be that, but for the 70s.
Right. Right.
But yeah, like. I know it's just been the most recent years, like past four or so, that like microprocessor-based games that had analog sound technology have really started like getting another pass on MAME and have started getting that more accurate.
Right.
Because again, a lot of these were made in dumps from the 90s that were not done with the accompanying technical information that you'd want today.
Right.
Even on top of that, there are and microprocessor-based games that aren't dumped because they're super rare and hard to come by now. Like, we mentioned PT-109 from Mirko, Spitfire it was Innovative Coin who did Spitfire. I had to look that up.
I had never even heard of them until now, and I
fly by
look
night.
Up this stuff. Yeah.
And then there's games from, like, big companies, like, you know, SNK is a whole thing now, and they got their start in the 70s with Breakout clones. They had like three of them, and I think only one's dumped. And Yosaku, which is a funky game where you're like chopping down trees, and it was pretty much unavailable to play in any form up until last year when the cassette vision, the Epoch cassette vision, finally got emulated, and now you can play their unlicensed clone of Yosaku.
Yes,
but. That was a very popular game, and can't play it.
Yeah. And there are, I mean, this is like one of the most fascinating ones to me is Sega's Heavyweight Champ.
Oh yeah, that game is so, you can find footage of this because like news reporting has been digitized and like posted online. I don't know how you'd find it necessarily, but there are stories about video games and they have like footage of Heavyweight Champ in there.
Yes, from this company called Sega, as they call it in the news report. And yeah, I mean, that's the first time like any footage of that game has surfaced.
It's like a fighting game.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And you have these very odd looking controls. I don't even know how they would work. They look like, I don't know. They just look like these weird handles that you're supposed to move up and down to like shift where your fists are. And the way that they do like your fighter getting woozy and falling over is like this weird, like wavy technique thing that they do, which I'm sure is just pulse width modulation, but damn, it looks cool.
It's not something you could do, like digital circuitry, at least not at the time.
No, not well.
Not well at all.
Yeah. But,
like, it works really well here, and
absolutely.
Like, it's a very cool game. I've never seen, like, an actual machine, and I'm not even sure if there are any actual machines of this left, but
I mean, again, if they are, it's one of those weird old collector hermits, you know, that really only talks to themselves, and these older collectors really tend to keep their cards close to their chests. They don't reveal a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah, there was some years ago, I was trying to track down someone who had an RCA coin arcade, because in 1975, RCA was exploring doing a microprocessor-based arcade machine that had sort of the same basic concept as the Neo Geo, where games would come on cartridges, you just swap them out.
With the
1802? 1801. Yeah, wow. The two-chip implementation before the 1802 came along. Okay. And they made six of these cabs, and a couple of them still exist, because I've talked to some folks I know in like that are old-time coin arcade machine collectors, and they're like, oh yeah, someone has that. I don't remember who, but I can see if I can track that down. And they could not, but it's okay. I don't want to delve into it too deep, but I think I've got a lead on something related to it.
Crossing my fingers.
So, but yeah,
crossing my fingers.
Really
for
cool
you.
Machine, but yeah, you can. It is emulated based on the schematics and like what we know about, you know, its sister machines like the RCA Studio 2 and etc. But
right. Yeah,
but it would be cool to be able to check that against the real hardware,
right?
And you know, get more of the games dumped.
But all this to say, you know, like you kind of hit the nail on the head earlier when you're talking about building interest, and it's hard to do that, because there's not a lot that's out there, but there is one way, and that is to just, I would go on like KLOV, right? And look up just by year, see what company looks interesting that made a bunch of weird games, and go on YouTube. There's not a lot, but what's there is pretty cool to look at and can hopefully like wet your whistle for like wanting to see more of this somehow. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whose door you would knock down to do that. maybe start with Atari. They've certainly been doing a better job being curators of their library.
Yeah, I made a note in here that there's not a lot of like commercialization of any of these games anymore.
No.
Even ones where the ownership is very straightforward, like Taito's still around. Midway, like Warner owns Midway. Atari still exists as a thing. Namco still exists. So, like, these are all companies that could ostensibly reissue these games. And they could probably finance people to do a very good job of it if they saw reason to do so.
But oh, gosh. Just getting two-player computer space out there would be lovely. I would love that.
But according to the Video Game History Foundation's Game Availability Study, only 0.89% of games from 1975 to 1979 were currently commercially available when their report came out. And that was basically through the Atari 50 collection and the Space Invaders Invincible collection. Yep. And the rate for 70 to 74 was statistically zero other than Pong. Mm-hmm. So we can't rely on the companies to do this.
Right. It's real dire. It kind of reminds me a lot of the silent film world, which is kind of one of my other big passions, which I know you share as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of silent film is just gone. You're not getting it back.
Yeah.
I think it's like 80% was the most recent figure estimate for silent films lost. I mean, I don't think you're in that big of danger when it comes to this. For instance, circuit boards aren't as volatile as nitrate, which is nice.
They're not going to burst into flame on you.
No, they might rust. But so I would say that it's not as urgent as silent film, but I think it's as close as you could get without being that. And I do think that there is some degree of urgency that needs to happen, especially as the people who made these machines are not getting younger. They're getting a lot older. And so those people are, we're losing that wisdom there about these games and how they worked and how they were presented. And, the way they work is just not something that's, I mean, when I learned how they worked, I just sort of brute forced it, you know? I made myself learn. And, you know, the schematics are things you kind of have to find, and some of them are easier than others. There's only so many copies out there. I mean, for Atari, it's a little bit easier, but for some other ones like Ramtech Baseball, I hunted literally for years to find a copy of the schematic for that. And I finally found it on a random auction house website for $30, and I scooped them up, and now they're online for everybody. So, do your part, support your local electronics nerd, buy old schematics and give them to people to scan. That's my advice to all of you.
If you want more reading about any of these things, obviously you can find YouTube videos. I know one source that I always really liked is that I think Jeremy Parrish himself was one of the people who ripped these History of Video Games laser discs that came out in Japan.
Yes.
And there's one for Taito and one for Namco. I don't remember if there's any others, but they were the first two Japanese video game companies, so unsurprising that'd be early. But they have some like direct capture video footage of these 1970s games. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool to see and see in very good quality, especially because yeah. I have never seen a Western gun machine running, and I don't know if I ever will.
Oh.
But now I can at least see like how it plays and how it differs from Gunfight, the like US adaptation of that game.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, Ed Fries got mentioned. Ed Fries, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, but he has a website, edfries.wordpress.com, where he has several blog posts about repairing some of these machines, notably Computer Space, Gotcha, Starship One, and Grand Track 10. Mm-hmm. And that's a very good way to dive into like all the issues with troubleshooting these machines and getting them to work again decades later.
Those blog posts are so cool. They're so inspirational to me.
They were great, and I feel like I should have tapped him for this at some point. It would have been fun.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
And the other good one I wanted to point out is All in Color for a Quarter, which is you know, no spaces, .blogspot.com. And this is a blog that historian Keith Smith ran for several years. He's really done a ton of research into the history of 1970s and 80s video games, and he's had quite a few posts on there about these topics, like these minor players, fly-by-night companies, or even the bigger ones like Exidy and Ramtech and Midway. So like it's a great resource. He wrote a book that he has not yet gotten published. I don't know where that's at. It's absolutely massive. I have a copy of the manuscript, and the doc file takes a good, like, 40 seconds to load on my computer. That's how long it is. But, like,
it's killing me that that book isn't released.
But, like, he's interviewed people who, you know, have died because he started doing this back in the 90s before any of these people were passing away. So it's a fantastic resource.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely hope he gets it out in some form or another.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's because the blog posts are so tantalizing.
Mm-hmm.
I would love a more thorough read into that. It deserves it. Those people deserve their due.
Mm-hmm. So I think in the end, like, check out these games. If you can find them somewhere, you should try playing them. It's an experience you probably won't find really anywhere else. And if you don't have that opportunity, at least, you know, check them out. Look them up. Look up some videos. Look up some flyers. Read about them. They're cool. And I really want more people to understand just, like, how neat they are in their own unique way.
Yes.
So, I guess we can just call it there since we're almost out of time.
Yeah.
So this has been Retronauts. It's a Patreon-supported show. You can support us at patreon.com/retronauts. And at the $3 level, you get each episode 1 week early and at a higher bitrate. And at the $5 level, you also get access to our Friday bonus episodes, weekly columns by Diamond Fight, as well as the Retronauts Discord server. So, it's a pretty great deal, and I highly recommend you follow suit, as I have, and I believe Nate has, backing it.
I'm a member.
And Nate, where can we find you on the internet?
I can be found on Blue Sky and Mastodon under the Fostodon server at Nathaniel Lockhart, just all one word, and that's IEL. Lockhart and HART. I do a little podcast called The Memory Machine and talk about old pop culture stuff. There was one we did about the history of screens going from the 1800s all the way up to stuff from 10 years ago and everything in between. Don't update it much. I have two young kids. Makes it very hard. In fact, I think I did like one this year, but I got two recordings scheduled this month. Getting back at it, baby. So I have that. There's also the website for it, memorymachinepod.com, which has show notes to my podcast, as well as blog entries for the builds that I've done and some of the work that I've done on 70s arcade games and from the book. And if you want to join me in my craziness, I have put corrected schematics for the video generation board from the David L. Heiserman book. They're on my GitHub along with PCB fabrication files. So if you want to send them to the PCB fab of your choice, I use JLC PCB. You can make those and, you know, descend into madness with me. And, that's everything.
So where can folks find you, Benj?
Yeah, you can find me at Benj Edwards on X, which kind of sucks these days, but also at Benj Edwards on Blue Sky or Mastodon. And I am, you know, writing stuff for Ars Technica all the time, AI things. So you can find me there or check out vintagecomputing.com, my old blog, which I occasionally update every once in a while. And hey, I did a book that's out this year about the Virtual Boy on MIT Press. You should go check it out. It's called Seeing Red.
Very cool.
That's pretty rad. You know, it's hard to get a book out through MIT Press, so you should be extremely proud.
Yeah, thank you. It's mostly Jose Zagal's doing. He got the contract first and then invited me along for the ride.
That's cool.
Yeah, as you can tell, I like obscure and weird video game experiences, and that's one of them. The Virtual Boy, you know, it's great.
I'll say.
That's why we wanted you on here, right?
Yeah, thanks, man.
And as for me, you can find me on the internet as a Ubersaurus, mostly on Blue Sky nowadays. I'm occasionally checking in on Twitter, but I try not to for my own mental health.
Yeah.
I also run the Atari Archive YouTube channel and website and Patreon. You can find the YouTube on youtube.com/AtariArchive and patreon.com/AtariArchive. And the website is atariarchive.org. And I also have a book under the same name That's published through Limited Run Games. It's also available on Amazon. And I talk about a fair number of these 1970s arcade games in the context of their Atari 2600 ports. So if this subject seems interesting to you, check my stuff out. And I know you've done podcast episodes on TTL games as well. So that might be some additional listening if you find the topic irresistible.
Yes. That's right. That's right.
And with that, I bid you all a good day.
Have a good night. From here to eternity, that's where she takes me. From here to eternity, she does, she does. From here to eternity, that's where she leads me. From here to eternity, we love, we love.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.